talk about the four noble truths in practice. And I want to ask you, maybe you'll be bold enough to raise your hands, how many people here suffered today? Okay, that's fine. Now, if we define suffering as all kinds of limitations, not being satisfied, or moments of not being satisfied, thoughts of self-judgment, thoughts of self-criticism, moments when we feel we could have done better, or we could be better, moments when we were not joyful and free, moments when we felt constricted, limited, and not expressing our full potential, finding suffering like that, now, who suffered today? It's life. And someone, a biologist, said life is nasty, brutish and short. So we feel, all of us, in some way limited, more or less, in our daily life, in our existence, more or less desiring for more freedom, more peace, more satisfaction, more desire, more energy, more things, more comfort, and less stress. And this is our existence. And that's the only one we have, as it happens. And we come to retreat, and many of us come to retreat for just a bit of relief. Like, just give me a break from all of that. At least the retreat, I can just go, from all that stuff. And then we come to retreat, and many of us find more stuff, more limitation. It's not happening. Where's the satisfaction? Where's the shalva? Where's the joy and freedom that I ought to be having? And I've got pains in the back and pains in the feet and pains in the heart and too many thoughts and too much worries and what am I going to do next? And so the retreat itself, it doesn't provide us with the way out that we want, and we want to even escape from that. What we forget, and what sitting here in the retreat might be able to give us or to hint to us, is that difficulty and suffering is the opportunity for us. It's not that the opportunity is there and the suffering holds us back, but the difficulty is the opportunity. It's that is the place where, and maybe the only place, that we can really begin to flower, to grow and develop. And that's because the difficulty is not something added onto our life. Like, we should be having a wonderful, great life, and then all comes this difficulty on us. And that's somehow wrong. The difficulty is truth. It is truth in difficulty, and difficulty is truth, or is a truth, or is an one way of looking at truth. It's not extra. It is the deepest expression of something in our life, and in all life, and in the life of every ant, and every cat, and every dog. And what happens is that we sit here quietly, not doing very much, minding our own business, as they say. Up comes difficulty, up comes suffering, boredom, I'm restless, I want to leave here, I'm much better somewhere else, I don't know why I'm here anyway, or pains, or, and we don't really call for it, we don't invite it, but it seems like as soon as we do nothing, we give space, then difficulty arises. And one of the images that's used, or that we can use for this, is that giving space by doing nothing, by just sitting and being, which is all really we are doing here. We're just sitting and to some extent watching ourselves in the mirror. And we're not doing much else, we're not acting in the world, we're not projecting ourselves into the world. We step back, we enter the retreat, we sit, we walk, we do the simplest possible things we can possibly do. Sitting and walking and eating and sleeping. And there's really nothing else. And just reducing everything down to the minimum. And this gives space for these things to come up. And we look at ourselves in the mirror. And to some extent, the looking in the mirror is like looking through water. And when we do nothing, the water becomes still. And when the water becomes still, we see the mud. We see the stuff down there. We see what's under the surface, which in our life, so often we find it difficult to do. And if we are active, and if we are concentrating in our meditation, and if we are directing our meditation, we're working with attention, the tool of attention, and the tool of attention is like a knife. It's also like a bit like kind of a big spoon that stirs up the stuff at the bottom of the soup. It's the stuff, it stirs up the mud at the bottom of the river, so the mud comes up. It's not just that we look through by doing nothing quietly, we look and see the mud, we actually stir up the mud through meditative attention. Tsumat lev is a power, and the power to generate stuff, it's called sometimes acceleration of karma. It's a professional term. It means just stirring the mud. And when we do that, what we are likely to come up with is these difficulties. And Simi talked about them this morning. We are liable to meet resistance. We're liable to meet the restlessness. We're liable to meet pains in the body. When our body is perfectly healthy and we will never get pains and we absolutely fine, we do yoga 3 times a day and we are the most fit, wonderful, flexible, free bodies. And doing Qigong every morning for 10 years, and all of a sudden we sit down doing nothing and oh, pain here and oh, pain there and oh, my knees and all. Where does it come from? Something is stirring up the mud. Something is stirring up the stuff there in the frame of the mind-body. Mind and body are connected, so in the frame of mind-body something's being stirred. We're awaking some demons. And our task, when faced with the difficulties, is to begin to be with them, to see this as an entirely natural process, understandable, natural, and right, and one by one to begin to peel off the layers that come up. And today all of us have been hearing in the groups many stories of how this happens, of how this is happening to some of us here. It happens in its own way, in its own time, and it's not entirely in our hands how much or what or when, but it does happen. That means we feel, for example, tiredness, and we don't understand why. All the time we're awake, suddenly we go on retreat and we feel exhausted, tired, sleepy, and all of a sudden we look underneath and we see it's holding something, it's expressing something, and we look carefully at this tiredness and we may find it opens to something else. Maybe an emotional issue, maybe a depression, maybe a difficulty, maybe an anxiety. So it's already a cover. And the anxiety doesn't come up and say, "Hello, I'm anxiety. Deal with me. Do something about me." The anxiety is inside the system. And when it's in the system, then it means it's covered. And what comes up when we stir the water, stir the mud, what comes up is the first things it allows us to see. The anxiety permits us to see only as much as it wants. And what we see, and what we see with our mind and with our mind-body, is maybe tiredness, maybe restlessness. In a sense, I want to escape from here. I want to leave. I want to run. I want to move away. I don't like the windows, the doors, the heat, the cold, I don't like something. Many of these are classical signs, and they're hiding things that are built into the system and written into the system, the language of our history, written into the mind-body system. And we need to learn to read this language, and the language doesn't express itself so clearly. Many of you heard this before, but I do like this little image of Rabbi Nachman, who said, what's human existence? Human existence is like an onion. You peel it, and what's left? Tears. And I must say that because of the Buddhist view of the ultimate nature of life and existence and the human soul, at the center of the onion, according to the Buddhist view, is tears of joy, not of pain. And thanks to Christopher for pointing that out when I told him this story. It's tears of joy. Because unlike perhaps the Western Judeo-Christian model of original sin, in the Buddhist model, it's original freedom, original joy. When we peel the layers of the onion, we come to original joy, original freedom, because that's the nature of the living experience. When the human mind, consciousness, touches life as it is, not the layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of disappointments, fears, problems and issues and conditioning, then the natural reaction is joy. The touch of consciousness, awareness, with the life process is joy. And that's what we are underneath. So the suffering comes from the fact that we can't control life, that we are the result of something. We are born into the life and we can't control it. It's obvious we can't control it. Just 5 hours without a meal here and we're already wondering what the stomach is turning and we're wondering when's the bell of supper going to be rung, and that's just 5 hours. I mean, we are not in control, and that's the primary issue for all living beings. And in a way, from the earliest moment we are born, we are dealing with, struggling with the issue that we're not in control, that life is controlling, not us. Life is the agenda, not us. And I have a little story, just something very, very simple, and of a child having a haircut. And this was read to me some years ago, and it's called Ordinary Heartbreak. And it's just a very small little example of this kind of thing which is happening to us millions of times in our life. So it's a girl that's having her hair cut, and it says the girl climbs into the chair and smooths the apron on her lap, and the hairdresser lifts her long hair and says, "Oh, it's very rough, like a horse's tail." And then, as if all that is to say, the woman at once cuts it off and throws one half a meter, a foot and a half of hair into the rubbish. And the little girl, who didn't want her hair cut, but long ago learnt successfully how not to say what it is that she wants, who even at this minute cannot quite grasp her shock and her grief, is getting her hair cut for convenience, as her mother put it. Long waves of hair gone that had been the evidence at night when loose that she might secretly be a princess. Rather than cry out, she grips her wrist and looks at her mother in the mirror. But her mother is too polite, or too reserved, or too indifferent to defend the girl. So the girl takes up the indifference, while pain follows a hidden channel to a place almost unknown in her body. Convinced as she is that her own emotions are not the ones her life depends on, she shifts her gaze from the mother's face back to the haircut now, so steadily as if this short-haired child she sees were someone else. So, it's just a little example of something about life is just continually disappointing us, continually frustrating us. We are subject to conditions. The conditions are constant. They are constantly conditions that we have to struggle to predict what's going to happen next, to control, to make the house warm, to make the food come, to make the clothes that we live, to make the house, to make the family, to make, you know, we're constant, and it's tiny little things that happen from the moment we're born. And the problem, or the issue, is we are made by conditions, and that's why we can't control them. We are made by conditions. We can't control our own birth. We're almost like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen comes together and makes a human being, collects together and makes a human being, and the human being is struggling to keep all the carbon, hydrogen and oxygen together in the same place and not go back to the earth. And so we're made by conditions, we're collected together by conditions, and we're struggling to keep this set of conditions, keep us going, keep us alive, and as it says in the Buddhist tradition, keep us free from pain and full of pleasure, to keep us loved and not rejected, to keep us alive and not dead, to keep us with things that we need and not without things. And that's our struggle all the time, and it's not only us, it's all the animals and all life. So in a way this is a biology, the Buddhist version of biology, the understanding of conditions and conditionality. But in the Buddhist tradition, this is not a fact like I learnt in the biology at school, that all beings need to eat and process food and da 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 da, like in the biology. This is experience. This is inner understanding, inner biology, if you like. So they've taken it one step further in the Buddhist teachings and said, well, life is a beautiful thing, a beautiful present, but it's also a very hard school and also a terrible big nuisance. And if we can, we'll try not to be born again, because it's such a bother to be back into life and have to go through all the struggle to keep going till finished. So there is another perspective, which I won't go into now, but it's another perspective on life, that life itself, because we have to struggle so hard to keep together this life, that's the suffering and that's the issue. And it's not separate from life. And that's the point I wanted to take home here. It's not separate. It's not something that there's life that ought to be a good and then there's suffering over there added on. It is because of life is suffering. Because of suffering is life. And this is the first noble truth. Four noble truths in Buddhism, and this is the number one. Why noble? Because if we understand this truth, it makes us noble. It's not that the truth is noble, it's makes nobility in us if we understand it. What is nobility? Nobility is a kind of code word in the tradition for a view beyond the limited self. Nobility is a view, a transcendental perspective, a point of view which is not just me. So you have noble truths, a noble path, and so on and so on and so on. It means the understanding of which creates nobility, creates a perspective beyond me and what I need in life. A more global, a transpersonal perspective. So what's the second truth? The second noble truth is that we are attached to things. We are attached to the need to control. The reason for suffering is because the need to control is so deeply in us that we are constantly attached to things, attached to our comfort, attached to all the things I mentioned before. Survival, needs, need to be accepted, need to be this, need to be comfortable, need to have, need to feel pleasure, need to run, work against pain, need to work against loss, need to push away discomfort, need to push away unpleasantness. This is the attachment, and it's stuck very close inside us. It's not just attachment, it's like we are in it, it is in us. And that's the second noble truth, the truth of attachment. And our task is to let go, not by force, but let go by wisdom, by understanding. And the first understanding, by the way, is understanding that we do suffer, and understanding that it's not a bad thing, but it's in the nature of existence, and therefore not our fault that we suffer, but it's in the nature of reality. How do we let go? And this is the value of meditation. And here we come to the value of meditation, which doesn't necessarily have to be vipassana, and it can be other forms of meditation. But the value of meditation is because the problem is not just in the personality. And therefore a lot of psychological work that deals with suffering cannot get to the root of the problem of attachment. Psychological work, work within the story, will only go so far to make our life easier. But because the problem isn't in the story, it's impossible that we'll go through life without the heartbreak, the ordinary heartbreak of this little girl. It's impossible that we go through life without this thing happening to us 1,000,000,000 times. Every disappointment, every pain, it leaves its history in us. So clearly we can't deal with it on the level of psychology, we can't deal with it in the level of working out our problems psychologically or with our own stories or understanding ourselves. We can understand as much as we want. We can understand what happened to me and my father and my mother and my school and the kibbutz and the army and the state and the, you know, understand, but it's all not enough to really let go on the deepest level. It's just not enough. And that's the value of a meditation process, a meditation life, because there's a possibility of really cleaning on a deeper level. And the reason is the meditation works on a deeper level. You don't need the story. You don't need to know what the story is. You can let it go by its signs, by its hints. You can let it go on the level of the subconscious. You can let it go on the level of impulses, little thoughts, judgments. Just let things come and let things go. Why is it that we're all, you know, months and months and months, years and years and years, our whole life, we're sitting, many people were sitting in meditation. You think that after a good course, that's it, finished. But it's not so easy, because the attachment is so deep, because it's in the nature of living experience, and therefore endless, a lifetime of cleaning, a lifetime of letting go, a lifetime of dropping and letting go and purification of the stuff, and there is no end to it. That doesn't seem like a very optimistic view, but wait. One of the issues why a spiritual practice, a meditation practice, works is also because the problem of human suffering is not owned by the self. It's not owned by me, by you, by each of us. I'll give you an example. Sometimes we think, you know, you hear it all the time in the street. Oh, all the problems are because of Ariel Sharon, and because of the Matzav, and because of Israel, and because we're here, or because of the Arabs, or this is all the stress and the problems, difficulty of life, and so on. It's all there. You hear, you know, blaming there. You hear it. Because of my parents, because of the university, because of the Kalkala, because of this, blaming there. But you know, when you hear that, that if all those were solved, that person wouldn't be in total universal bliss. There'd just be something else. So what's happened is the blame has been put outside. But the opposite also happens. Imagine someone who's sick, and there's a tendency in the alternative medicine movement to blame ourselves for being sick, and say, "Oh, we didn't do it right, we didn't eat right, we didn't take enough miso soup, and that's why we got ill this winter." And there is a tendency to blame us. I was really shocked, actually, a little while ago. When I heard the statistic that in the Mifratz Haifa, is the highest level of breast cancer in the world. In the world. Because of the pollution there. And it's just obvious. There is the highest level of breast cancer in the world. There is the chimneys and the stink and the pollution that you can see it and you can smell it and you know it. And yet the people who get cancer, if you ask them why they got cancer, or they will often say, well, God did it to me, or I don't know, it's in the genetics. And if you say, will you join a campaign to clean the Mifrat, to ecological campaign, and this I was involved in this as my work with ecology, they say, no, we know this. They don't make a connection. It's not, so in other words, it's me inside, I must be the victim of this issue. It's clearly not true that this person, these cancer cases are not from inside only. They are the chimneys of the factories right there. You see it and you know it and the science shows it and so on. So clearly, problem of suffering is not entirely in here, in the person, and is not entirely out there in conditions. So it cannot be said that you can solve the problem entirely in here, and it cannot be said you can solve the problem entirely out there, and the problem of suffering is in the relationship between the two, is somewhere not in the person, not only in the person and not only in the conditions of life, it's in the relationship, it's in the formation of the person through the conditions, the way the person is formed by the conditions of life. There is the suffering, and therefore you can't just deal with it on a level either of the outside world by making a kind of paradise. I understand America was supposed to be a paradise from the first settlers there. You can't deal with it only on the level of inside. My story, my life, my biography. Supposedly, you can't. It's not only there. It's somewhere else. And that's the value of meditation, because meditation is about present in life, relationship in life, me, moment by moment experience as I encounter the world through the breath, through the food, through the air, through the sun, through the touch, in life between the two. And that's where the healing, that's where the understanding, the wisdom happens, that's where the cleaning process occurs. And that's the process of meditation. We touch reality and we let it go. The process of not identifying, but just observing and letting things go, letting things change, letting things pass by, difficult one moment, not difficult another moment. This flow, which we are sitting there steady, present, allowing the experience of life to flow and not being attached anymore. Not being involved, having it to be like that, or having it to be like that. Must be pleasant, must not be painful. We sit quietly and we let the flow happen. And we know it. And that process is the process of non-attachment. It's not detachment. It's not distance. It's involved in life, so it's non-attachment. And I think at this point then you'll understand a little more clearly the importance of those messengers that we talked about before. The tiredness, the pains in the body, the wanting to escape, the aversion, the pushing away, the, oh, it's not happening for me, or I want it better, or I want joy now. All that story, all that, these messengers of difficulty, I think we now understand that they are special opportunities to work, because it's there when we let go and we understand and let go these, in these places they do have a special power. They do have a special potential. learning deeply in ourselves the truth of the nature of difficulty and the truth of the nature of release from difficulty, release from attachment. And here is the third of the noble truths, release. Because every time we let go, a space appears. When we let go things that we're attached to, in its place is a space. In its place is a kind of area of freedom that wasn't there before. We are not as trapped by all those things and the history and so on, and the frameworks and the disappointments and the ordinary heartbreak. We are lighter, we are freer, and that's the good news. So although we do need to keep practicing all our life, and the Buddha practiced till the day he died, so why not us? But every time we drop something, it creates a space. It allows us to have space in which there is a more healthy and non-attached relationship to the life process. And life takes the place of our difficulties, our disappointments, our wounds, our hurts, our scars. Every time we let one go, then the life takes the space that was there before, more free. And so that's the good news. That's the third noble truth, the truth of the ending of suffering, the truth of liberation, the truth of freedom, the third noble truth. And to give you an example, I've got another little story that I found, and this is from a book called Grace and Grit, which is written by Ken Wilber about the disease, the cancer, and process of his wife. And she had cancer and she died. And this is the story, their story together. And this is her her words. I remember very well my attitude when I first discovered that I had breast cancer. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die. It's bound to happen sometime. If this is the way it is to be, so be it. Then I decided that this acceptance might be dangerous. I decided I had to choose very specifically and definitely to live, to force myself to choose to live. But that created more worry. I was calling the doctor more. It went with more fear of death. Therefore, holding on to life comes to mean fear of letting go. And so the secret is to hold everything a bit more lightly. A light touch lets me have a desire to live and be willing to let go when the time comes. Balance on a razor of will to live and acceptance. And worry is the clue to when we are off this balance. So this living more lightly with a life process and not a suffering process is the third truth. And the fourth truth is helped by all the other truths. The fourth truth of the fourth noble truth is the way to live. If we understand all these, if we understand noble vision, transpersonal vision, awareness, what do we do with it? And the fourth noble truth is the way to live. How we live with this understanding. And it relates to a quotation that I gave the last talk, which maybe many of you didn't understand, and maybe you still won't understand. Maybe it's the language, it's not so easy. But I the quote from Padmasambhava, who said, "Let your vision be as high as the sky, but sieve your actions very fine like flour." Yeah, I don't know, it's maybe the English was, I didn't get a response, maybe many of you didn't understand it, but it's very deep, to me a very deep statement. That is, big vision, but in this world, act very carefully, act very awarely, be very sensitive, be aware of the small things, because that's where the action really happens. It can't go back. Once you are on the path, once you see this, understand this a little bit, you can't go back into a kind of mindless suffering again. It's every step is a step that moves you forward. And then the way of life builds this into your structure, builds this into your existence. So and the knowing of it builds the way of life, and the way of life builds the knowing. And that's why in the Fourth Noble Truth is also the meditation. And so it's in a way a circle. The meditations and the awareness and the practices lead to understanding, and the understanding leads back into a way of life, which leads back into the understanding, and so on, and it goes around. The way of life with this awareness is very, very clear. We can only take care of the world. We can only do that once we understand this, the Three Noble Truths. Then the fourth is very clear. Not always clear what to do exactly, but the movement in the soul is to take care of the world, to look after, to be caring, to give nutrition to yourself and to others, to feed spiritually, psychologically, physically, to feed yourself and to feed others. You will not be able to add to suffering. You know the story of suffering, you know how much it's an essential character in life, and you will not be able to throw more suffering, or not want to throw more suffering into the world with your actions and with your way of life. And so the Fourth Noble Truth embodies that. A life of non-harming, a life of virtue, a life of giving, a life of relationship, a life of nutrition. And it's the only possible way once you see the three other truths. Thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes.